About 10 days ago, I went to another memorial service for a friend in the radio communications branch of search and rescue that I'm active in, Whatcom Emergency Communications Group. First, a month ago, Larry died. Larry was the most active volunteer for radio emergency communications at the hospital. And his memorial service was at the Church of Latter-day Saints in Everson. And then more recently, Don was the head of the radio communications for the Bellingham chapter of the Red Cross. And his memorial service was at the First Reformed Church of Linden. So my wife, Diane, dropped me off for the memorial service. We got onto the street where the church was, and we saw the First Christian Reformed Church. But the address wasn't quite right, and realized that we're looking for the First Reformed Church of Linden, not the First Christian Reformed Church. So we went down the street a little further, and we passed the United Reformed Church and a sign for the Bethany Reformed Church, where we came to the right address block, where there was clustered the Faith Reformed Church, the Third Christian Reformed Church, and what we were looking for, the First Christian Reformed Church of Linden. So she dropped me off, and I went in, and they were playing some entry music. And I thought, well, this music is a lot nicer than the music at Larry's memorial service. Because that's what we do, right? I mean, everything is evaluation. Everything comes up, and we're either leaning into it or leaning away from it. And this was good music. Funerals and memorial services are interesting because we learn about different aspects of a person. Larry's memorial service was very much that way. It was basically three totally separate contingents, the search and rescue group, his family, and the Latter-day Saints group, and none of them knew anything about his life in the other groups. And of course, we're all that way, right? There's aspects of us that nobody really knows all of them, including us ourselves. Right? It's kind of support for that notion of this idea of the self not being a solid, fixed item. So as Don's service went along, I came to the realization that I was at the wrong memorial service. This was a memorial service for another search and rescue member named Don. But I did stay anyway, because I found it moving. This Don was also a very caring person, and there were a lot of people who cared about him. And it kind of brought to mind Norman Fisher's discussion of the importance of doing something useless, which refers to our spiritual practice, that if we expect to get something out of it, we're probably not right on the path. But yet, practice with the matters of the heart comes really to be something that we can touch and be there for us. And sometimes I worry about intolerance, particularly with so many religions that we have. But if the messages that are being discussed in small group churches on corners across the country once a week are anything like what I experienced in the Latter-day Saints and in the First Reformed Church of Linden, I think the country's on an okay path. So that kind of brings us to look at the our own memorial service here at Red Cedar, in which the core words are, in the Dharma world, there is no coming, no going, no birth, no death. Buddha's light shines on everything, revealing the mystery of suffering and the end of suffering, revealing the heart's natural healing power. And there's an acknowledgement of the offerings that we make, and then may the deceased find rest and come to understand the true shape of life's journey as we all forever fulfill Buddha's way. So we've been studying Dogen, the teachings of Master Dogen, this year, and what really jumps out for me is at the end of that, as we all forever fulfill Buddha's way. As we're sitting in practice, thinking about being angry or being hungry or being happy or throbbing in the shoulder, we are forever fulfilling that way, and that is the act of fulfilling the way. May the deceased find rest and come to understand the true shape of life's journey, and that true shape brings up the Buddhist notion of true self, right? What is the true self? It's not this one that we're looking at and typically contemplating. It's bigger than that, and the true shape of life's journey is bigger than that. The phrase, in the Dharma world, there is no coming, no going, no birth, no death. It's a clear reference to the Mahayana teachings of emptiness, that our notions of birth and death are too specific, too concrete. And yet Buddha's light shines on everything, revealing the mystery of suffering and the end of suffering, and revealing the heart's natural healing power. So in this context of emptiness is a recognition, a counterpoint, like the front and back foot in walking, that also we're immediately feeling, and we're immediately with that natural healing power. So here's a story about skillfully coursing in both that Dharma world and that healing heart. When Master Wanzhui was about to die on Mount Wutai, he said to the monks around him, "I've heard of masters passing away while sitting or lying down, but have any died while standing?" "Yeah, some," they replied. "Well, what about upside down?" asked Wanzhui. "No, we've never heard of such a thing," they said. Wanzhui stood on his head and died. And his robes continued to drape his body in a dignified manner. The monks decided it was time to take his body to be cremated, but it was immovable as a stone pillar. People from near and far came to marvel at the amazing sight. Wenjue's younger sister, the nun Wenji, came to the place. She scolded, "Older brother, when you were alive, you flouted the laws of the Dharma, and even now that you're dead, you're still causing problems and making a nuisance of yourself." She gave the body a little push, and it toppled to the ground. Then the monks took the body to be cremated. Well, I'm going to leave my reflection on that in the words of Melissa Myozen Blacker, who is the abbot of Boundless Way Zen in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Worcester.
She writes, In Zen practice, we emphasize a delight in paradox and an energetic love of life lived fully. My teachers always encouraged me to be both spacious and suspicious about anything I thought was true, and I continue to encourage my students to go beyond their conventional ideas about the nature of reality. This attitude of freedom from convention can lead to becoming a person who enjoys making trouble. And this koan tells the tale of two excellent Zen troublemakers. In this version of the story, they are a sister and a brother, Wenji and Wenjue. They are wonderfully fresh and alive in their commitment to playing with ordinary understanding, even in the face of death. The brother in this story, Wenjue, is a particular kind of troublemaker. He wants his death to be special. This is not unusual for us human beings. Many of us have a similar desire to stand out from the crowd, to do something no one else has done. We want to be seen and known for our uniqueness. Of course, everything each one of us does is completely unique. There is no need to prove this. But insisting on our special qualities can get us into a lot of trouble, making life difficult for everyone, especially ourselves. The brother dies upside down, thumbing his nose at the convention of ordinary death. But Wenjue is not a simple narcissist. When we look more closely, we can see that his upside-down death is a representation of Wenjue's insight into the magic of emptiness, where mountains dance and everything is alive with possibility. He had penetrated ordinary reality and had entered the upside-down kingdom of awakening. But what are we going to do with such an absurd declaration? His body, stuck in emptiness, cannot be moved. This creates a real problem for everyone. When we have had an opening to non-duality, the coming together of opposites, we can get stuck there. Some teachers call this Zen sickness, and it can last for some time. Everything is empty and upside down. There are no consequences to what we do. Wisdom, compassion, equanimity, and the precepts, all the long-developed fruits of Zen practice, can go right out the window. We become Dharma bums and feel free and wild. Halfway through the koan, when her brother's body becomes as immovable as a stone pillar, Wenji takes over. She is not stuck in emptiness, but has entered the more mature view where all apparent dualities are seen through, and life becomes much simpler. Many Zen teachings set us up to compare opposites, form and emptiness, life and death, special and ordinary, male and female, brother and sister, and then topple down our ideas about any separation between them as Wenji topples her brother's body to the ground. The wise sister has no patience with her brother's emptiness-oriented death. His upside-downness is playful, but it also demonstrates the limitation of this intoxicating period of opening. No one can move his body. His sister comes along and knows exactly how to rebalance emptiness and form. With a quick shove, she sets things right again, and her brother can be buried. She is the kind of troublemaker who speaks truth to power, who says it like it is. Such clarity and balance save us all. It's so important in our own lives to enjoy the freedom of emptiness, but never to ignore the consequences of form. There is no death, and we all die. There is no male or female, and only women can give birth to a child. Living an awakened life is not so complicated. We get up in the morning, go to the bathroom, get dressed, and do our work. There is nothing special, and in this nothing special, everything shines with its own light. I was in an argument recently over how to program stations into a radio, and the crazy stuff that we argue about sometimes. And after discussions of this that went on and off for a few weeks, one of the people, and we're really coming narrowing down to a conclusion, one of the people said, I can't live with this. It has to be this total other way. Which just, I was flabbergasted and had to step away for a bit to cool down. But recognizing that the only way out of it is, you know, back into discussion, back into to facing the conflict with each other. It kind of felt like when I was a child once, I stuck my hand in a faucet where the water was scalding and shrieked and pulled my hand out. And my mother immediately turned the faucet over to cold, and my father told me that, you know, to make the pain go away, I had to cool my hand off. But you want me to put my hand back in there? I know what happens when I put my hand. I'm not going to put my hand back in there. You're trying to kill me. And sometimes it does take a lot of bravery to go back to face each other. But to not do so in the moments before I was able to at that point. Anger looked closely at just felt like a sticky poison, you know, something that just sits there burning away, causing damage. And just a quick caveat there that I don't mean to imply that, and really bigger to recognize, I don't think any of the Zen teachings are implying that we should go back and place ourselves in harm's way. But sometimes we do have to go back and just re-examine ourselves in the process. Oftentimes there's an analogy used, talk about bending like a willow in the wind, you know, which means that maybe we're willing to look at things a little differently. But I want to look at some of the options of trees in the wind, with the analogy, of course, being how we live our lives. There's oak trees, which don't give very much in the wind. I was in France during a tempest where a number of forests around Versailles, entire forests, 90% of the trees, these big oak trees, snapped off about 6 feet above the ground from the wind. There's trees not getting, and that's probably not a good model on how to live our lives. Then we look at cedar. Here we live in the Northwest, and if you've been hiking much, you see what happens when cedar gets caught in the wind. It topples over. You know, the roots, the whole roots just come up in the air. Maybe that's not a safe approach either. So I was thinking about cottonwood. We have a number of 80-foot tall cottonwood trees where Diane and I live. And whenever there's, you know, we get, in the wintertime here, we get a storm every few weeks, right? Big windstorms. And every time there's a storm, the cottonwood loses huge limbs, often 15 feet, but not uncommonly 30 feet limbs fall off of these trees. And initially it's like, well, that can't be evolutionarily beneficial. But then again, when the wind is big enough and you lose that limb, now the wind load is reduced on the tree. So that is how it survives the wind. So here's an invitation from the Buddhist perspective to lose big chunks of ourselves. Right? Maybe look at some of the attitudes that I have, like I am a person who's always sick, or I'm a person who is always on time. Or I'm a person who is always fill in the blank, that maybe if we can hold those a little less closely, a little less dearly, we'll be able to come back to the table. Now, of course, giving away big chunks of ourself like that, there's a caveat with that, that, you know, there's a danger there of harming self. And so that should be done only with the when it can be done with the confidence that nothing is actually being lost. Speaking of different types of wood and death, let's pull up some Dogen. So we've been studying the Genjo Koan the last few weeks. Firewood becomes ash and does not become firewood again, yet do not suppose that the ash is after and the firewood before. Understand that firewood abides in its condition as firewood, which fully includes before and after, while it is independent of before and after. Ash abides in its condition as ash, which fully includes before and after. Just as firewood does not become firewood again after it is ash, you do not return to birth after death. This being so, it is an established way in Buddha Dharma to deny that birth turns into death. Accordingly, birth is understood as beyond birth. It is an unshakable teaching in the Buddha's discourse that death does not turn into birth. Accordingly, death is understood as beyond birth. Birth is a condition complete in this moment. Death is a condition complete in this moment. So death is beyond death. It fully includes before and after, but only because we experience this moment. Only because we engage life. The point of the Genjo Koan teaching is recognizing the emptiness that's taught in the Mahayana teachings, that what we imagine to be the boundaries of ourselves and the boundaries of everything that we see is illusion, and we go about our business in the everyday world in order to make that true. Firewood abides in its condition as firewood. Looking at that word abide, it abides, it endures, it continues on in the condition as firewood. Even though it becomes ash, there is still firewood. This particular firewood. Birth is a condition complete in this moment. And then emphasize on the word condition. Condition is a temporary intersection of events. With causation, the process by which change happens, the world and time is a web of causal chains, and all discrete phenomena, including me, in this moment, are simply intersections of those causal chains. So, as Melissa Miozen Blacker says, we get up in the morning, go to the bathroom, get dressed, and do our work. It is in this activity of living life that we endure, that Buddha abides, that I give birth to new stars in the Andromeda Galaxy, and that I become a movement of thousands of subsistence farmers demanding peace. And so this talk is a condition complete in this moment.